So now we are beginning, and I'm glad you're all here. This is meeting number 116 in all.
Wow.
116.
Amazing.
I thought this would be kind of neat, especially for some of you. And memory lane for others of you. I pulled out some old Senecals.
Poem by Jim Burke III?
Yeah.
A poem by
Jim Burke III.
Wow.
That was when you get to hour.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, and just signed JB3, October
1994. That's my moniker. When was it written?
October 1994. Universe is a black hole falling through the sky. I usually only see the sunlight with my eyes closed. As the aliens of the dark come to haunt me, I know there's no way out, so I survive.
Oh,
all right.
Thank you. Couldn't remember better. Don't remember writing it, but I couldn't remember. That's the truth.
And you guys will find many, many, many poems by Rick in many of these Senecals. There's all sorts of poems.
I found one I haven't seen before.
There's a tribute through time to Rick Amonte.
This is your life.
Yeah.
This is called Star Rover. Philosophers make love in their heads, as well they should. Formulate principles independent of flesh, folly, mystery. But tonight, the stars rage and sparkle, dig and stitch a larger pattern that inquires, transfixes. Beyond answers, trust. Beyond thoughts, wonder. Beyond certainties, love. Blue fields of starlight sway through the black. We live now and again. We one day will fly.
I don't remember that. Sure. Okay, here's one from the June 97 issue. What issue was that from?
This is 2001. Wow.
So 4 years earlier. So this one is called Dream Poem. I was holed up in a large house with an old man. There was a war on out the window, and plainclothes soldiers were walking single file 50 feet apart down the street I grew up on. I opened the door, and a soldier came at me. We wrestled and fell to the floor, and I held the soldier down while the old man stabbed him in the head. The blade wouldn't stick, kept sliding out as the old man sawed at his throat. Woolly, deep red clots of blood clung to the blade, now still and embedded lengthwise in the right half of the soldier's throat. I was sitting atop the soldier, my knees pinning his biceps, and reached down and tore his face away to find an Oriental man, close-eyed, expressionless, maybe dead, maybe alive, I couldn't tell, and didn't seem to care.
In the furnished rooms of America, the International Congress of Hot Plate Mystics boils pelican juice in dented aluminum saucepans. In the furnished rooms of America, glow-in-the-dark condoms unroll in the thick mist. In the furnished rooms of America, pensioned Gandhi dancers expectorate onto parquet floors. Aspiring televangelists mug and strut before duct tape mirrors. In the furnished rooms of America, paperback Dostoevskys swell the brave pant. Dream dinosaurs roam the sheets. Human cheese plugs the drain. Androgynous antediluvian pundits, punks and sots scour sour tectonic plates with pneumatic glee. In the furnished rooms of America, in the furnished rooms of Cambridge, Mary Baker Eddy watches the Jetsons into furnished rooms of Boston. Ralph Waldo Emerson upbraids a roach. In the furnished rooms of any town, USA, nicotine-drenched spider plants, corrosive pharmacopoeias, lugubrious jockstraps, sumptuous dust kittens, epistemological nose hairs, sardine genuflections, beer can Sanskrit, three gleaming pennies and a shaving cream cap on busted blue nightstand in the furnished room of America.
Welcome to the 16th anniversary issue of the Senecal. It amazes and humbles me to have been editor of this periodical for so long and to be blessed with such gifted contributors. I look back over the years better to look around and ahead. I began writing when I was still a child, and it became a way to imagine myself beyond my life's inadequacies. My family had little money, struggled with daily living and perpetuation. There is an art, even a poetry, in suffering, in deprivation, but I believe that after a while, the lessons are learned. No more subtleties or new angles. Just suffering, plain envy of others who have more. And why? Just because. So I wrote because it was in my control, because it did not have the usual limits. It wasn't about my limitations or that of my family or anyone else's, really. No, it was about possibilities. How far could I go? How good could I be? I didn't know and eventually learned nobody else did either. This was excitement, not ego. Hope, not greed, for acceptance. Mystery without end. I think in writing. Long have. Conversations or dialogues. The voices of loved ones when inspired some to speech, to poetry. Art abounds everywhere, all around, at least possibly. If me, then you, then anyone in this hotel lounge, on the streets, across the world. Art is our native water, all of us, why the simplest of us yearn to music, why we dream anarchically every night. It is our great inheritance, it is why we are conscious, to make art. Pause, look around. I don't see a better answer. What I do see is discontent on all levels, and answers which often seem to delay happiness to some far day, if not till after death itself. Or answers that simply say, to be human is to suffer. One deserves it. Repent and then maybe, no really. Answers that will bring happiness upon learning a code of conduct, mastering a behavior of denial and repentance, and so on. I see art as the answer because it is the simplest. Art acknowledges that the same set of hands can shape metal and wood to a statue or a rifle. It is possible to create nation-states and then craft reasons to cause them war with each other, or choose peace as though it is not always right. I believe causing harm, conscious, needless harm, is always unnecessary. There is always a choice, another possibility. No human faith or polity is definitive, and therefore none is invulnerable to exploitation. We, each of us, can be tricked into causing needless harm to each other and to our world. It happens all the time. Does not mean tomorrow isn't a new day. It is new and next, both. Taken as such, one is able to remember and keep moving. As my dear friend Burke has often said to me, we are what we were, but not what we shall become. Tomorrow is new and next. It's okay. Pause again. A breath is always good. Publishing this periodical to me is an act of faith, my gesture of what I value to spend my hours with, my gesture of what I value to spend my hours with. Art is what I believe in, what I preach, what hope, what direction, what purpose. I believe we create our histories as individuals and history as a race. We shape and change, and nothing is impossible. We stand in our own ways and always have, as evidence in every war, every slaughter, every needless harm of this miraculous living creation. And yet, tomorrow is possible and possible and possible. It's always now doing the writing, the creation. Now is the ultimate and perennial living work of art. Feel it in your hands.
Yeah.
Thank you. Thank you.
Yeah, very nice.
Thank you.
That's really nice, right?
Thank you.
It's more than nice. It's
thank you.
It hits.
Because not everybody I know agrees with my thoughts. I'm very much against death penalty, but I have and I tried the arguments have all been made. I mean, you know, the basic ones are, well, it's a deterrent, which I find to be so impossible for somebody to argue. It's a deterrent. Well, it keeps happening every day. People are murdered in this country without any forethought to what's going to happen afterwards. A lot of the time it's done in the heat of passion, the spur of the moment. Sometimes it is planned. I mean, sometimes, and more often than not, the people that they charge in something are guilty. But, of course, and then they've, you know, and the article goes on to say, well, of course, people will say an eye for an eye, and if I quote the Bible at their convenience, and things like that. And, of course, though the overriding, which I really delved into from a sociological perspective, was what happens when they get the wrong person?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
I mean, above and beyond, and they have. The Innocence Project, I don't know how familiar with it, everybody is with it, but
mm-hmm.
They...
It's a DNA testing thing, isn't it?
Yes, right, exactly. That's what it is. It's DNA testing, and which is simply, I mean, I think it's 0.99. It's like nine. Literally, well, they really have never gotten one wrong using the DNA test. In other words, they haven't found. It's like fingerprints. They haven't found two people with identical fingerprints. Now, considering there's 4 billion people in the world, I think it's safe to say it's an infallible method as you can get. And the Innocence Project has found so, and I think it's in the article, has found so many people through genetic DNA testing innocent of the crimes they were convicted of. The vast majority of, and I had to shorten that paper was going to go on and on and on, but But then I simply decided to just, if you want to really, I'll tell everybody here and anybody else, if you want to really get the information, go on the website, theinnocentproject.org. It will tell you everything. You would not believe some of the stuff. I mean, these people serving decades in prison for crimes they didn't commit, or on death row for a decade, and turns out they're innocent.
Mm-hmm.
And that's happened. Those people would have been executed. But before DNA testing, I'm quite sure there were a lot of people that have been executed for things they didn't commit.
Mm-hmm.
Especially in Texas.
I
was going to say, Texas has the highest rate of executions per capita. They also have the highest rate of indigent minorities, the inadequate resources to have public defenders really defend them in any meaningful way. You know, I mean, the one with the most money does indeed win. To use the example a little loosely, O.J. Simpson. I mean, he had a lot of money. He had the best attorneys, and pretty much people agree. Now, conversely, he got away with murder, literally. There's too much of a disparity. And so when they do get, and still to this day, when they do get the wrong person, the Innocence Project doesn't have enough money to be able to help all these people.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they've got to send people out there to study the case. They have to get voluminous court documents, get stays of execution, they can only really pick the ones that they're absolutely convinced that the person is innocent. And just about all the time, I think that person has been proven innocent through DNA testing. There's some states want to get the laws in the books that will make all capital crimes subject to DNA review, which I think would be at least meeting the Innocence Project halfway. Of course, they want Texas, Louisiana, Virginia. You know, coincidentally, they're all down south.
Florida.
Yeah, I don't know, some kind of mentality.
Thank you. place you are, where love falls from the trees. My heart is like a broken cup, I only feel right on my knees. I spit out like a sewer hole, yet still receive your kiss. I cannot measure up to anyone now, at the central of this list. Well, you.
I've read out of this book a bunch of times. This is like his greatest hits.
Who is it?
There's a guy named Billy Collins.
All right.
He's got this way of writing. He just twists stuff up so well.
Victor introduced us to Billy Collins at Jellicoe Guild meetings in Portland. He brought books over and read us extensively and won us over. Not only is Billy Collins, in my opinion, a really good poet, but aside from the man himself, I believe no one reads Billy Collins aloud better than Victor.
Oh, well, I don't know about that.
I honestly believe that. When you hear, you think Victor wrote the poem, he's so in tune with the words.
Yeah.
Let's see. Now, I'm only raising the expectations a little bit here, Victor.
Okay, I'll read it. I was always kind of taken by this, and I've read this one before at one of the Jellicoe Guilds. This one's called... I chopped some parsley while listening to Art Blakely's version of Three Blind Mice. I chopped some parsley while listening to Art Blakely's version of Three Blind Mice. And I start wondering how they came to be blind. If it was congenital, they could be brothers and sisters. And I think of their poor mother brooding over her sightless young triplets. Or was it a common accident? All three caught in a searing explosion? A firework, perhaps? If not, if each came to his or her blindness separately... how would they ever manage to find each other? Would it not be difficult for a blind mouse to locate one fellow blind mouse with vision, let alone find two other blind ones? And how, in their tiny darkness, could they possibly have run after a farmer's wife, or anyone else's wife, for that matter, not to mention why? Just so she could cut off their tails with a carving knife is a cynic's answer. But the thought of them without eyes and now without tails trails... through the moist grass or slip around the corner of the baseboard, has the cynic who always lounges within me, up off the couch and at the window, trying to hide the rising softness that he feels. By now I'm dicing an onion, with which might account for the wet stinging in my own eyes, through Freddie Hubbard's mournful trumpet on Blue Moon, which happens to be the next cut, cannot be said for making matters any better.
That's great.
Oh, you know, the question about angels was good, too. Questions about angels. Of all the questions you might want to ask about angels, the only one you ever hear is how many can dance on the head of a pin. No curiosity about how they pass the eternal time, besides circling the throne, chanting in Latin, or delivering a crust of bread to a hermit on earth, or guiding a boy and a girl across a rickety wooden bridge. Do they fly through God's body and come out singing? Do they swing like children from the hinges of the spirit world, saying their names backwards and forwards? Do they sit alone in little gardens, changing colors? What about their sleeping habits, the fabric of their robes, their diet of unfiltered divine light? What goes on inside their luminous heads? Is there a wall these tall presences can look over and see hell? If an angel fell off a cloud, would he leave a hole in a river, and would the hole float endlessly along, filled with the silent letters of every angelic word? If an angel delivered the mail, Would he arrive in a blinding rush of wings, or would he just assume the appearance of a regular mailman and whistle up the driveway reading the postcards? No, the medieval theologians control the court. The only question you ever hear about the little dance floor on the head of the pin where halos are meant to converge and drift invisibly. It is designed to make us think in millions, billions, to perhaps run out of numbers and collapse into infinity. But perhaps the answer is simply one. One female angel dancing alone in her stockinged feet, a small jazz combo working at the background. She sways like a branch in the wind, her beautiful eyes closed, and the thin, tall bassist leans over to glance at his watch, because she has been dancing forever, and now it is very late, even for musicians.
That's really, really nice. I'm going to read something from Invisible Man, which I've been thinking about lately. I haven't read it for a long time, but still I was able to find two portions that I thought were interesting. I am an invisible man. No, I am not a spook like those who haunted Edgar Allan Poe, nor am I one of your Hollywood movie ectoplasms. I am a man of substance, of flesh and bone, fiber and liquids, and I might even be said to possess a mind. I am invisible, understand, simply because people refuse to see me. Like the bodiless heads you see sometimes in circus sideshows, it is as though I have been surrounded by mirrors of hard, distorting glass. When they approach me, they see only my surroundings, themselves, or figments of their imagination. Indeed, everything and anything except me. Nor is my invisibility exactly a matter of biochemical accident to my epidermis. That invisibility to which I refer occurs because of a peculiar disposition of the eyes of those with whom I come in contact, a matter of the construction of their inner eyes, those eyes with which they look through their physical eyes upon reality. I am not complaining, nor am I protesting either. It is sometimes advantageous to be unseen, although it is most often rather wearing on the nerves. Then, too, you're constantly being bumped into, bumped against by those of poor vision. Or again, you often doubt if you really exist. You wonder whether you aren't simply a phantom in other people's minds. Say, a figure in a nightmare, which the sleeper tries with all his strength to destroy. It's when you feel like this out of resentment that you begin to bump people back. And let me confess, you feel that way most of the time. You ache with the need to convince yourself that you do exist in the real world, that you're a part of all sound and anguish, and you strike out with your fists, you curse, and you swear to make them recognize you. And alas, it's seldom successful. So I'm going to jump to the back.
That's by Ralph Ellison.
Ralph Ellison. And one of my favorite books that I haven't reread for a long time.
That's really wonderful writing.
It is. And so I'm just going to catch up while there's a little more that's sort of... So there you have it. All of it. There's a whole story in between, right? Pages and pages and pages. So there you have it. All of it that's important. Or at least you almost have it. You really almost have it. I'm an invisible man, and it placed me in a hole, or showed me the hole I was in, if you will. And I reluctantly accepted the fact. What else could I have done? Skip again a little bit, dot, dot, dot. Let me be honest with you. A feat which, by the way, I find of the utmost difficulty. When one is invisible, he finds such problems as good and evil, honesty and dishonesty, of such shifting shapes that he confuses one with the other, depending upon who happens to be looking through him at the time. Well, now I've been trying to look through myself, and there's a risk in it. I was never more hated than when I tried to be honest, or when, even as just now, I've tried to articulate exactly what I felt to be the truth. No one was satisfied, not even I. On the other hand, I've never been more loved and appreciated than when I tried to justify and affirm someone's mistaken beliefs, or when I've tried to give my friends the incorrect, absurd answers they wish to hear. In my presence, they could talk and agree with themselves. The world was nailed down, and they loved it. They received a feeling of security. But here was the rub. Too often, in order to justify them, I had to take myself by the throat and choke myself until my eyes bulged and my tongue hung out and wagged like the door of an empty house in a high wind. Oh, yes, it made them happy. and it made me sick. So I became ill of affirmation, of saying yes against the naysaying of my stomach, not to mention my brain. So this is on the example of bay leaves. Luckier than a four-leaf clover, alias Gar Alidaphne, sweet laurel, the bay leaf smacks of its own sweet, dry bark. Its savor deepens without disturbing its determined exoskeleton, without distressing its bony delicacy. The bay leaf's form recalls itself. Cracked, the phantom edge retrieves, without necessity of hope, its leafy wholeness. Torn, its fan-like frame will not tear away. Forcibly crumbled, its flavor keeps. Only in dreams and night terrors does anything so assaulted in us cling so true along our bones. War's frenzy cannot reclaim its sacrifices. Weeping does not return the taken. Rage will not conjure from remains the motion, the grip of hands, the turn of phrase, the pulse of mind that lit the eyes. And you, of vows and mirrors, who living could not detain, should I awaken you from phantom edges, engrams of old socks, and that one shoe tucked beneath the bed? Would song or word or prayer regain your chain of heartbeats, indifferent to hope, unself-conscious, that a random rap of fortune could deliver your whispered life away?
Good grief.
That's good.
That's wonderful.
Thank really? You.
That just started somewhere and it ended like continents away.
Happens.
Read another. Victor hasn't heard you read before.
Okay, let's see. Okay, we'll do this one.
I mean, I'm pretending I'm saying it on your behalf. I really want to hear more poetry.
Okay.
I'm using you as a prop.
I think you're projecting, Ray.
I am
that
projecting.
Nice
I apologize.
Of you. Very nice of you. So, this one's called Dust. There's too much dust, you said, and a layer had increased everything. TV screen, desk, the unopened cleaners. And you shook them, unsettled them, floated dust mites around the house. You were angry. There's too much noise, you said, and you were poking, prodding, muckraking, mad at the squirrels who ate their nuts and threw them to the ground, chitting. There's too much, so you claim. We are uneven, clamorous, scrappy. There's a world of peace that can't contain itself in this din. It breaks out. It counters visions, purity. Its feet are propped on the table. It clatters through the house. The dust is disturbed again, like silence.
Okay, I'll read two things, a prose poem and a non-prose poem. So, prose poem's called Sign Language. The banshee wail of a metal saw rips along a crumpled red fender in Bay 8 at today's collision, quote unquote. It's today's collision of particles, sometimes smooth, like service. This metal on metal, rougher. A facade of seven spry white doors, followed by a box of sonic mayhem, ending in a corner wall of plate glass office, showcasing tall plants, blonde wood, soft lighting. Against plastered walls of burnt sienna hang framed color photos of gleaming cars. On glass-top waiting room tables leer glossy flotillas of celebrity magazines. And Miss Nordquist, the receptionist, knows about makeup and attitude. It's all central casting and faux elegance here, while behind cushioned walls, an earplugged Vinny or Sal throws down blue and orange sparks. The contrast between the staged and antiseptic beauty of the reception area versus the elemental maelstrom of the work pit is stark and vast. But the greater paradox occurs at 3 a.m, when the streets are empty and silent, and the stars overhead are their own benediction. And the equanimity of the lone and drowsy passerby is shattered by the blood-red electric doom of 3-foot-high letters, jolting and jostling nighttime reverie with the unwanted, forceful, and ominous message, today's collision. Roll your own. Is there a better way to exalt the moment? So muse numberless mystics through centuries of praise and pain, each fresher and vaster than the last. And one shall do so with early fire of sunrise, traipsing in hushed and pliant light among sundial shadow of pine. And another shall do so by sitting, reciting a syllable while becoming a stone, echoing the gift of eternity. And a third will break open her heart, launching ions of compassion and love that rend the dark ecstatic. But now, back in the thick of it, whose method crowns the horror? Who strings stars and skulls from the same wispy filament as best and worst reconvene? Truth is, there is no answer. Questions masquerade as flower and bone. The angle of being is a medley of minds. Work with one that doesn't flinch.
Love that last one. I love that last
tough guy. Metaphysical tough guy. Work with one that don't flinch, buddy.
Really, I love that last one. Tough guy.
Yeah. But anyway, so this book is really interesting because it's a young adult novel, which I kind of enjoy reading a lot. But this one particularly, so first it won the Newbery Award, which is, you know, the Young Adult Award. And then it won the equivalent of that in Britain, England, whatever. And then it won the Hugo Award, which, like, no book has ever won all three of those, because the Hugo Award is
a science fiction award
for, like, actual, like, adult science,
right.
Real, authentic right. science fiction award books. So it's this book that has just mass crazy appeal. It's called The Graveyard Book, and I'm going to read from the beginning. Epigraph, is that what that is?
Yeah.
Yeah? Epigraph. So it's a traditional nursery rhyme. Rattle his bones over the stones. It's only a pauper who nobody owns. Graveyard Book. Chapter 1, How Nobody Came to the Graveyard. There was a hand in the darkness and it held a knife.
Okay. Ominous.
The knife had a handle of polished black bone and a blade finer and sharper than any razor. If it sliced you, you might not even know you had been cut, not immediately. The knife had done almost everything it was brought to that house to do, and both the blade and the handle were wet. The street door was still open, just a little, where the knife and the man who held it had slipped in, and wisps of nighttime mist slithered and twined into the house through the open door. The man Jack paused on the landing. With his left hand, he pulled a large white handkerchief from the pocket of his black coat, and with it he wiped off the knife and his gloved right hand, which had been holding it. Then he put the handkerchief away. The hunt was almost over. He had left the woman in her bed, the man on the bedroom floor, the older child in her brightly colored bedroom, surrounded by toys and half-finished models. That only left the little one, a baby, barely a toddler, to take care of. One more and his task would be done. He flexed his fingers. The man Jack was, above all things, a professional. Or so he told himself, and he would not allow himself to smile until the job was completed. His hair was dark and his eyes were dark, and he wore black leather gloves of the thinnest lambskin. The toddler's room was at the very top of the house. The man Jack walked up the stairs, his feet silent on the carpeting. Then he pushed open the attic door and he walked in. His shoes were black leather and they were polished to such a shine that they looked like dark mirrors. You could see the moon reflected in them, tiny and half full. The real moon shone through the casement window. Its light was not bright, and it was diffused by the mist. But the man Jack would not need much light. The moonlight was enough. It would do. He could make out the shape of the child in the crib, head and limbs and torso. The crib had high, slatted sides to prevent the child from getting out. Jack leaned over, raised his right hand, the one holding the knife, and he aimed for the chest. And then he lowered his hand. The shape in the crib was a teddy bear. There was no child. The man Jack's eyes were accustomed to the dim moonlight, so he had no desire to turn on an electric light, and light was not that important after all. He had other skills. The man Jack sniffed the air. He ignored the scents that had come into the room with him, dismissed the scents that he could safely ignore, honed in on the smell of the thing he had come to find. He could smell the child, a milky smell, like chocolate chip cookies, and the sour tang of a wet disposable nighttime diaper. He could smell the baby shampoo in its hair, and something small and rubbery. A toy, he thought, and then, no, something to suck, that the child had been carrying. The child had been here. It was here no longer. The man Jack followed his nose down the stairs through the middle of the tall, thin house. He inspected the bathroom, the kitchen, the airing cupboard, and finally the downstairs hall, in which there was nothing to be seen but the family's bicycles, a pile of empty shopping bags, a fallen diaper, and the stray tendrils of fog that had insinuated themselves into the hall from the open door to the street. The man Jack made a small noise then, a grunt that contained in it both frustration and also satisfaction. He slipped a knife into its sheath in the inside pocket of his long coat, and he stepped out into the street. There was moonlight, and there were streetlights, but the fog stifled everything, muted light and muffled sound, and made the night shadowy and treacherous. He looked down the hill towards the light of the closed shops, then up the street where the last houses wound up the hill on their way to the darkness of the old graveyard. The man Jack sniffed the air, then without hurrying, he began to walk up the hill. A little bit more. Ever since the child had learned to walk, he had been his mother's and father's despair and delight, for there never was such a boy for wandering, for climbing, for getting into and out of things. That night he had been woken by the sound of something on the floor beneath him falling with a crash. Awake, he soon became bored and had begun looking for ways out of his crib. It had high sides, like the walls of his playbin downstairs, but he was convinced that he could scale it. All he needed was a step. He pulled his large teddy bear into the corner of the crib. Then, holding the railing with his tiny hands, he put his foot onto the bear's lap, the other foot on the bear's head, and pulled himself into a standing position and half-climbed, half-fell over the railing and out of the crib. He landed with a muffled thump on a small mound of furry, fuzzy toys, some of them presents from relations from his first birthday, not 6 months gone, some of them inherited from his older sister. He was surprised when he hit the floor, but he did not cry out. If you cried, they came and put you back in your crib. He crawled out of the room. Stairs that went up were tricky things, and he had not yet entirely mastered them. Stairs that went down, though, he had discovered, were fairly simple. He did them sitting down, bumping from step to step on his well-padded bottom. He sucked on his number, the rubber pacifier his mother had just begun to tell him that he was getting too old for. His diaper had worked itself loose on its journey on his bottom down the stairs, and when he reached the last step, when he reached the little hall, the diaper just fell off. He stepped out of it. He was only wearing a child's nightshirt. The stairs that led back up to his room and his family were steep, but the door to the street was open and inviting. The child stepped out of the house a little hesitantly. The fog wreathed around him like a long-lost friend, and then, uncertainly at first, then with increasing speed and confidence, the boy tottered up the hill.
Wow.
Oh, that's great. I'd
buy
with you the whole book now.
It's a great book. He walks up to the graveyard, and it turns out that since they don't know his name, they name him Nobody. And that's how Nobody came to the graveyard. It's because a man was after him to kill him when he was a baby.
24 years ago, a coming in the sky. Some old woman and the man who lived in strife. He was tired of being born. And he was an sounding door to door. And he worked like the devil to be more. A different kind of poverty now upsets me so. Night after sleepless night, I walk the floor and want to know why am I so alone? Where is my woman? Can I bring her home? Have I driven her away? Is she gone? Morning comes the sunrise, and I'm driven to my bed. I see that it is empty, but the devil's in my head. I embrace the many colors. I grow
weary of the torment. Can there be no peace?
And I find myself just wishing
that my mind would surely cease.
These are poems that begin the seventh series of my Many Music series, which I've been writing for a number of years. And Many Music's seventh series begins with the epigraph, There's no final answer, Dr. Timothy Leary.
Timothy Leary's dead. We all know he's on the outside looking in. He'll travel the astral planes, come back the same day again. Timothy Leary, Timothy Leary.
So I've been writing poems that are partially inspired by dreams. What I'm going to do is I'm going to just go from poem to poem to poem, and you just...
Well, so I'm going to get a feel for it.
Play as you will.
The usual...
And I don't think I'm gonna read. I don't think I'm gonna read the titles because I don't think the titles are absolutely necessary in this instance. That night we sat watching that old movie with Bing Crosby and that young starlet whose name we never knew, and you asked me the question. And I sit here in the subway station with the trains going by both ways, as though the choice is as easy as the choosing, this way or that one. And I suppose I could have looked up her name in the time since you've been gone, but I haven't. I sit here again, watching and not choosing. You ask me the question I'm still not answering after all this time, and I think, if I finally answer, I lose you, for you will smile no matter what I say and turn away for a moment and think of other things. All night I stared at him, lying on his deathbed, eyes shut, long gray beard tucked above his blanket, silent, still. And I kept coming back over and over from wherever else, a circuit returning me to this slow dying, in this strange place, locomotives and cypress trees, from where he'd ruled, where he'd created, where he'd loved. It seemed a warning, a warning. The years pass and I keep returning, still dying, still the sense of mourning nearing. We owe the dead nearly all, but what to those dying in our dreams? The famous artist and his wife, she of the many veils and scarves, led the golden tiger through the town, its crowded parks of pink cheeks and tossed balls. The tiger padded along noiselessly, a monstrous hunger beneath teeth and tawn, stopped for a word, a photograph, an embrace. The artist answered each time, healing is hereon. Gestured softly to his robust tiger, and then his pale wife, veils pushed back. Later, perhaps, the tiger lounged among frail bones and remaining bits of flesh. To meet this hour's music, finally, and follow its pathless course, you must generate silence enough to blanket the past's cries and moans. You must eat the tiger, too, in all, leave no bones, nor even a scent. The bugs kept getting bigger in that studio, a room and a window and a toilet, and they were of different kinds. Some like me, they knew my want for touch, they laughed. I imagined them laughing, but they laughed. They crawled in her skin, her face and arms, never his, as they danced in tatters on my wall, never his. Hung from her bonnet, peeked up, peeked down, offered to tell, knew I'd say no. Dancing close with her, holding her hand, her embrace, he no more possessed her than I did in my half-sunk chair. They laughed. They knew. From the basement we protested. It was tight and dirty, and I kept forgetting against what? A bent idea called God, the next king. I turned to one of the younger bodies, warm light still on her face. She used words somebody else had said, whispered in that dank of old blood with bookish fervor. heated more on a distant fire. Turned to an older one, his mind a familiar scar from the many meetings and scrambles through shouting hours that had brought us here. He huddled me close and said there was no more light worth up there worth knowing. Memories. Eyed that younger one with a lingering stroke. By last chance, I turned to my own face in the basement's half-remaining antique mirror. I saw nobody else in its reflection as I dodged my eye and face. It's been a rough stretch. I turned and explained, hoping somebody else was there. Only the darkness and the thought of your name, your smile. You were near, nearer. The pencil softened during transit. I noticed this the first time, and it occurred to me to kill them all and bring you back with me to this hopeful new hour. You would like it here, with your curiosity and dagger's wit. No, that dog isn't quite a dog. He's from here on, and it didn't quite work, so he's not fully here. It upsets him that he cannot speak. We touch his tawny fur, caress his warmth, love him all we can, but he cannot say his name. Yes, the pencils. I think it means that when we go, we also don't return quite the same. You'll see, your console is nearly ready, nearly built. No, we cannot go out there, now or ever. This room is safe from all but the planet's own destruction. But we can't leave. We can love each other and the world forever, in the past, the future, but never now. He had loved the law when a strong young man, how it flowed and changed through time, how it emerged from men's hearts and fears, but also from the world around them, if the land was hard or fertile, if the snows came for 6 months of the year. Supple and sublime, he called it, a powerful beast in every crack and shadow. It spoke to him of changing eternals. He dreamed it in his bachelor's chambers until, on a street past sundown, he met a woman in a pink dress and red bonnet. More supple, more sublime. His pages cracked. On his usual street corner now, he fingers the payphone for change, hikes the rope of his oily trousers, mumbles to his blue doll of the conspiracy between pink cheeks and the ships overhead. I lean closer to listen from an empty store doorway. I do not wish to become him. They'll find nothing left when they finally come for me. My books are gone. My health. I'll crack open at first touch. Lizard bones in the desert sun. The old argument between now, tomorrow, and eternity, I've traveled a while and haven't decided. Back then I sang them spirituals and blues to keep things close. I told them God rode with them on their hunts and a bit of God fell when one of them did. It seemed fair to say, if not true. They liked it, kept people out. Later I worked with a rich man, found him things, razors, talking pillows. He thought I had the magic. No, I didn't. I don't. I told him. I've traveled. The possible and the impossible are not adjacent lands. Pointed to the sunset. Try to keep it in your hands. Since then, I've just kept it all in my head and looked for new work. These times need a magic I do not have or know, need a preacher and a prayer greener than the ones around here. But I don't want to leave. It's where I've been traveling to. Only disbelieve in nothing. That's what LSD taught me. In time I said that too. Only disbelieve in nothing, and again, only disbelieve in nothing. That night in the TV news studio, as they dosed my buddy and me for the cameras, dripping it down our faces, saying this was how it was done. The man being interviewed, the expert on this, he's taking donations and signing people up. No trouble happened because of any of this, he continues, and I think he sounds like he's been to the future and knows for sure. My buddy and I laugh. This is what happens when the experts go on TV and start to explain. I met him at a party at a dilapidation near the city of scholars and beggars. We were both long homeless then. The party was for travelers like us at crossroads and tired. The game going on as I arrived was a favorite, simply called Chains, a reminder of what happens when you stop moving. The dilapidation had no roof to comfort or conceal, to lie that every soul tonight slept warm and caged. There were the heady local periodicals on plastic tables, dense erudition made to capture a melodic fancy and dissect a fang to its meaning. Among the periodicals were squat jars of the dreaming juice. You could tell by its heavier drinkers by their whispered song. Sometimes I am me, sometimes I'm not. Sometimes I'm arriving, sometimes passing through. He noticed to me the rhythm of the place, its restive hum, how nothing here abided agreeably in time. We huddled with others near the wall and laughed at the film about the crazy dog from the future, never quite arrived. It learned, in time, to croon its wish to land in music or despair. When the soldiers came to stifle the open-air sex cries that worried the preachers and their nests on nearby streets, my buddy and I left to travel on a while together. The morning was quiet, not yet sunrise, between breaths of wind a silence. We left the city of scholars and beggars and to its thousand-year decay, to what men will think when none need crawl a thick tome for answers, nor any need wish pages made better food. What the others come here for isn't important. We're told to skin for devices. The lower drawers, safes in the walls, keep looking in the laundry, the trash, they're somewhere. This hotel is bugged as a project high-rise, told again and again. So we look, some of us. I think most just need the job and keep moving room to room. We all have our reasons, that's all. I come here day after day to find you, to sniff you out. Sometimes I think I just want your scent one more time. Sometimes I think once I find it, I'll follow it back to you. If any man could, it would be me. It was mine first. Wasn't it? I think so. I let that matter to me. I skin for devices, find them, never turn them in, or give them to the worst of us to do. I'm sniffing for you, that's why I come. I tasted you in one of these rooms 30 years ago. Our eyes, one, watching you above me below you, entering, receiving, no difference. Yes, you whispered and smiled. I'll find you. I'll follow you back. And finally, the madcap scholar laughed and leaned forward on the couch. The best mystics say we earn free will, like some of us learn to sing. My friends laugh and take pictures. It's a good night. The house is run through with candles and pipes. He follows me for some reason down into a basement room. Several of us are nude and making a film for one of the girls, her dead brother. It's a sad film. Here's love, says the scholar quietly, for your path here on. Like the best parties, with great scholars and all, there's a bomb. Two of us are crouched over it in the tent, defusing it. The scholar looks at me, the best of him in passing, says, what for? You can tell me now. I nod toward the girls dancing with each other inside the house, up to the stars ever trying to get us to listen to the answers being offered, down to the pieces of defused bomb at my feet, and shrug, and not again.
Nice. But I wanted to read you one paragraph from The Last Unicorn, because you read it's not a kid's book, but it could be. The unicorn lived in a lilac wood, and she lived all alone. She was very old, though she did not know it, and she was no longer the careless color of sea foam, but rather the color of snow falling on a moonlit night. But her eyes were still clear and unwearied, and she still moved like a shadow on the sea. She did not look anything like a horned horse, as unicorns are often pictured, because being smaller and cloven-hoofed, and possessing that oldest, wildest grace that horses have never had, that deer have only in a shy, thin imitation, and goats in dancing mockery. Her neck was long and slender, making her head seem smaller than it was, and the mane that fell almost to the middle of her back was as soft as dandelion fluff, and as fine as cirrus. She had pointed ears and thin legs with feathers of white hair at the ankles, and the long horn above her eyes shone and shivered with its own seashell light even in the deepest midnight. She had killed dragons with it and healed a king whose poisoned wound would not close, and knocked down ripe chestnuts for bear cubs. There.
Oh, thank you.
Hi, Ray. Hi, Cassie. I hope you're all well. I'm happy to be with you tonight at the Literary Guild meeting. I hope you can see me. I hope you can hear me. I'm on Kibbutz near Oz, and I'm going to read the haiku that Ray selected for the current issue of Seneca. As you probably know, haiku don't have titles in general, so I'll just pause between each one. Okay? So here I go. Clowns ahoy! Puppets and surprise. Boundaries dissolve. Tel Aviv women. Ballet flats, Street Smart. Neighborhood sleeps. One small light over kitchen stove. Dreams reveal ancient connections. Symbols speak. A vessel, slippery with compassion, life slides through. Out of the lotus, soft pearl thoughts hatch and arise. Bottom blues line. Young bird takes solo. Approach of spring. On top of dreams, crack of daylight. Peacock alert. Right now I hear a peacock. Steely-toed acrobat. Balance of mind and gut maneuvers the Tao. Daylight prods dream, another chance to dance with the hummingbird. Birds this early morning sing Saturday song uninterrupted. Arise thoughts, take chances. Why not? Okay, that's it. Bye and have a good meeting. Thank you. This is called At Night. All day I thought of the city, of freeways and overpasses, and tunnels long enough that you might be afraid there is no end to them. When late afternoon came, it came with a pissy attitude and solar temper. I closed my eyes tight, like gritted teeth. Every night we are newly dead, and every morning newly born. That alone should make me happy, but it doesn't. What does? The thought of my good bed, my dreams of concrete clouds, air that smells like old clothes, the eccentric lamplight on sputtering streets, the ominous openings of alleys. Now it's late. My neighbor's vodka has numbed my tongue, but not my heart, which is holding a grudge. Perhaps I should meditate or take drugs. The choice between Shiva and Seroquel is not always a wise one. Tonight may be one of those nights when sleep is a joke, I tell myself. Tonight may be one of those nights when holding on to the mattress is as close as I'll ever get to nirvana. This is called Because You've Lived. Because you've lived is reason enough to die. Love stays on. Hunger stays on. The sky stays on. Real as grit, you'll be here again. This is called cremation. Once upon a time, in the middle of the night, in the middle of a thunderstorm, in the middle of my life, a woman came to my bed to be held. She stayed until the sky no longer needed lightning to see itself. I wasn't sure then which laws applied to the situation. And now it doesn't matter. When I sift through the boxed ashes of that night, I find some other person's bones and teeth. I wonder where she is now. This is called Elegy. You will be led to a place behind the white concrete building. Your hands will be tied. Gently as putting a bit in a horse's mouth, a black handkerchief will be tied around your eyes. The firing squad will be made up of you, dead parents, your children, your ex-spouses. They'll be given your life story on a postage stamp to stick onto the envelope that becomes home to your bloodless heart.
The cormorant spreads angled wings to a naked early morning sun, heraldic Mesozoic spare. Tremble and adore the breath and hush of the reptile brain.
W.S. Merwin is a poet that Joe deeply admires, and this poem is called The Last One. Well, they'd made up their minds to be everywhere because why not? Everywhere was theirs because they thought so. They with two leaves, they whom the birds despise. In the middle of stones, they made up their minds, they started to cut. Well, they cut everything because why not? Everything was theirs because they thought so. It fell into its shadows, and they took both away, some to have some for burning. While cutting everything, they came to the water. They came to the end of the day. There was one left standing. They would cut it tomorrow. They went away. The night gathered in the last branches. The shadow of the night gathered in the shadow on the water. The night and the shadow put on the same head, and it said, now. Well, in the morning, they cut the last one. Like the others, the last one fell into its shadow. It fell into its shadow on the water. They took it away. They took it away. Its shadow stayed on the water. While they shrugged, they started trying to get the shadow away. They cut right to the ground. The shadow stayed whole. They laid boards on it. The shadow came out on top. They shone lights on it. The shadow got blacker and clearer. They exploded the water. The shadow rocked. They built a huge fire on the roots. They sent up a black smoke between the shadow and the sun. The new shadow flowed without changing the old one. They shrugged. They went away to get stones. They came back. The shadow was growing. They started setting up stones. It was growing. They looked the other way. It went on growing. They decided they would make a stone out of it. They took stones to the water. They poured them into the shadow. They poured them in. They poured them in. The stones vanished. The shadow was not filled. It went on growing. That was one day. The next day was just the same. It went on growing. They did all the same things. It was just the same. They decided to take its water from under it. They took away water. They took away the water, went down. The shadow stayed where it was before. It went on growing. It grew onto the land. They started to scrape the shadow with machines. When it touched the machines, it stayed on them. They started to beat the shadow with sticks. Where it touched the sticks, it stayed on them. They started to beat the shadow with hands. Where it touched the hands, it stayed on them. That was another day. Well, the next day started about the same. It went on growing. They pushed lights into the shadow. Where the shadow got onto them, they went out. They began to stomp on the edge. It got their feet. And when it got their feet, they fell down. It got into eyes. The eyes went blind. The ones that fell down, it grew over, and they vanished. The ones that went blind and walked into vanished. The ones that could see and stood still, it swallowed their shadows. Then it swallowed them too, and they vanished, while the others ran. The ones that were left went away to live if it would let them. They went as far as they could, the lucky ones with their shadows.
Whoa.
So I have one more proxy reading. I've been busy trying to pull in the disparate spirits.
Pull in the disparate spirits. And
so that they're here with us. You know, it's kind of neat. And he asked for me to read a letter by the poet Rainer Maria Rilke, German poet. So Rilke, is anybody not familiar with Rilke? He's a German poet.
I don't have a clue.
Okay. Right. So Rainer Maria Rilke was a German poet who lived around the turn of the 20th century. He was, I guess you'd say, a romantic poet, very expressive. His poems are philosophical, romantic, very symbolic. They're kind of hard to read, some of them, but some of them are very direct and emotional and gripping. And so he's a very well-known German poet. He, when he was still a relatively young man, he'd gone to a military academy and had a really bad time there when he was a young person. And when he was later, now a poet, published some books, a young fellow teenager who went to the same school found out they had that connection.
When was he born?
Like 1875 to 1926 or something.
Okay.
Yeah. He's one of Rick and my favorite poets. So he started writing letters. He was like a teenager maybe, and he was at the same school, and he was like, that was the connection. It's like, I'm writing a letter because you're a famous poet, and I need to know about life and things. And so Rilke wrote him this famous series of letters.
Oh, so it's like, it's sort of a philosophical text, sort of, in a way.
Yeah, he's trying to give the guy, some advice about life.
And the guy must have hit his muse just right, too.
Yeah. Yeah, I think he understood, you know, you're at the school I was at, and I guess they had the same teacher. Maybe the teacher mentioned, oh, yeah, Rilke went to school here, and that kind of just stated the correspondence. So the young fellow is named Kappus. I don't know what his first name, Eugene or something. And this is one of the letters Rilke wrote to him that Ralph requested. It's written from somewhere in Sweden, August 12, 1904. I want to talk to you again for a little while, dear Mr. Kappus, although there is almost nothing I can say that will help you, and I can hardly find one useful word. You've had so many sadnesses, large ones which passed, and you say that even this passing was difficult and upsetting for you. But please ask yourself whether these large sadnesses haven't rather gone right through you. Perhaps many things inside you have been transformed. Perhaps somewhere deep inside your being, you have undergone important changes while you were sad. The only sadnesses that are dangerous and unhealthy are the ones that we carry around in public in order to drown them out with the noise. Like diseases that are treated superficially and foolishly, they just withdraw and after a short interval break out all over again, the more terribly, and gather inside us in our life that is unlived, rejected, lost, life that we can die of. If only it were possible for us to see further than our knowledge reaches, and even a little beyond the outworks of our presentiment, perhaps we would bear our sadnesses with greater trust than we have in our joys. For they are the moments when something new has entered us, something unknown. Our feelings grow mute in shy embarrassment, everything in us withdraws, a silence arises, and the new experience, which no one knows, stands in the midst of it all and says nothing. It seems to me that almost all our sadnesses are moments of tension, which we feel as paralysis because we no longer hear our astonished emotions living. Because we are alone with the unfamiliar presence that has entered us, because everything we trust and are used to is for a moment taken away from us, because we stand in the midst of a transition where we cannot remain standing. That is why the sadness passes. The new presence inside us, the presence that has been added, has entered our heart, has gone into its innermost chamber, and is no longer even there. It is already in our bloodstream. And we don't know what it was. We could easily be made to believe that nothing happened, and yet we have changed as a house that a guest has entered changes. We can't say who has come, perhaps we will never know, but many signs indicate that the future enters us in this way in order to be transformed in us long before it happens. And that is why it is so important to be solitary and attentive when one is sad, because the seemingly uneventful and motionless moment when our future steps into us is so much closer to life than the other loud and accidental point of time when it happens to us as if from outside. The quieter we are, the more patient and open we are in our sadnesses, the more deeply and serenely the new presence can enter us, and the more we can make it our own, the more it becomes our fate, and later on when it happens, that is, steps forth out of us to other people, we will feel related and close to it in our innermost being. And that is necessary. It is necessary, and toward this point our development will move little by little, that nothing alien happened to us, but only what has long ago been our own. People have already had to rethink so many concepts of motion, and they will also gradually come to realize that what we call fate does not come into us from the outside, but emerges from us. It is only because so many people have not absorbed and transformed their fates while they were living in them that they have not realized what was emerging from them. It was so alien to them that they had not realized what was emerging from them. It was so alien to them that in their confusion and fear, they thought it must have entered them at the very moment they became aware of it, for they swore they had never before found anything like that inside them. Just as people for a long time had a wrong idea about the sun's motion, they are even now wrong about the motion of what is to come. The future stands still, Mr. Kappas, but we move in infinite space.
That's an awesome way to put that, actually, that last couple of paragraphs.
How could it not be difficult for us? And so to speak of solitude again, it becomes clearer and clearer that fundamentally this is nothing that one can choose or refrain from. We are solitary. We can delude ourselves about this and act as if it were not true. That is all. But how much better it is to recognize that we are alone. Yes, even to begin from this realization. It will, of course, make us dizzy. For all points that our eyes used to rest on are taken away from us. There is no longer anything near us, and everything far away is infinitely far. A man taken out of his room, and almost without preparation or transition, placed on the heights of a great mountain range, would feel something like that. An unequaled insecurity, an abandonment to the life of the nameless, would almost annihilate him. He would feel he was falling, or think he was being catapulted out into space or exploded into 1,000 pieces. What a colossal line his brain would have to invent in order to catch up and explain the situation of his senses. That is how all distances, all measures, change for the person who becomes solitary. Many of these changes occur suddenly, and then, as with the man on the mountaintop, unusual fantasies and strange feelings arise, which seem to grow out beyond all that is bearable. But it is necessary for us to experience that too. We must accept our reality as vastly as we can. Everything, even the unprecedented, must be possible within it. This is in the end the only kind of courage that is required of us, the courage to face the strangest, most unusual, most inexplicable experiences that can meet us. The fact that people have in this sense been cowardly has done infinite harm to life. The experiences that are called apparitions, the whole so-called spirit world, death, all these things that are so closely related to us, have through our daily defensiveness been so entirely pushed out of life that the senses with which we might have been able to grasp them have atrophied, to say nothing of God. But the fear of the inexplicable has not only impoverished the reality of the individual, it has also narrowed the relationship between one human being and another, which has, as it were, been lifted out of the riverbed of infinite possibilities and set down in a fallow place on the bank where nothing happens. For it is not only indolence that causes human relationships to be repeated from case to case with such unspeakable monotony and boredom. It is timidity before any new, inconceivable experience which we don't think we can deal with. But only someone who is ready for everything, who doesn't exclude any experience, even the most incomprehensible, will live the relationship with another person as something alive and will himself sound the depths of his own being. For if we imagine this being of the individual as a larger or smaller room, it is obvious that most people come to know only one corner of their room, one spot near the window, one narrow strip on which they keep walking back and forth. In this way, they have a certain security, and yet how much more human is the dangerous insecurity that drives those prisoners in Poe's story to find out the shapes of their horrible dungeons and not be strangers to the unspeakable terror of their cells. We, however, are not prisoners. No traps or snares have been set around us, and there's nothing that should frighten or upset us. We've been put into life as into the element we most accord with, and we have, moreover, through thousands of years of adaptation, come to resemble this life so greatly that when we hold still through a fortunate mimicry, we can hardly be differentiated from everything around us. We have no reason to harbor any mistrust against our world, for it is not against us. If it has terrors, they are our terrors. If it has abysses, these abysses belong to us. If there are dangers, we must try to love them. And if only we arrange our life in accordance with the principle which tells us that we must always trust in the difficult, then what now appears to us as the most alien will become our most intimate and trusted experience. How could we forget those ancient myths that stand at the beginning of all races, the myths about dragons that at the last moment are transformed into princesses? Perhaps all the dragons in our lives are princesses who are only waiting to see us act just once with beauty and courage. Perhaps everything that frightens us is, in its deepest sense, something helpless that wants our love.
Holy shit. Mr. Rilke. I brought some Rilke to read.
Good.
Oh. He just read Rilke. And this, Letters to a Young Poet, that's been published in, you know, for a number of years. It's well known. But I came across this, which is like Poems, Notes, and Dreams by Rilke, which is like, but anyhow, I culled one thing. No, this reminds me, this is kind of like in the tone of Letters to a Young Poet.
Yeah.
He calls it morning prayer, but it's kind of that advice type thing. And he, I mean, my understanding of Rilke is he grasped with the big issues in life over and over and found different ways to approach them.
Yeah.
But his thing to me was always an individual has to embrace their particular fate.
Yeah.
You know, you can use different spiritualities and other belief systems to help you, but, you know, it
means
comes
to an end.
Yeah, it means to an end. And I was thinking as you were reading that, this Kerouac has this great line. He said something like, be in love with your life, every last detail of it. You know, even when you're going through misery and pain and suffering, it's special because it's your time here, your consciousness processing that.
Nice.
So it's a weird gift as
yeah.
well as a burden.
Yeah.
But anyhow, so this addresses this a bit. Called Morning Prayer. On work days, arise to your labors happily, if you can. And if you can't, what's stopping you? Is there something heavy, something difficult in your way? What do you have against what's heavy and difficult, that it can kill you, All right, so it's strong and powerful. You know that much about it. And what do you know about what's easy? Nothing. We have no memory at all of what's easy. So even if you were permitted to choose, wouldn't you actually have to choose what's hard? Don't you feel how kindred it is to you, related to you through all your loves? Is it not your true home? And aren't you in harmony with nature when you choose it? Don't you think the seed would find it easier to stay in the earth? Don't the migrating birds have it hard and the wild animals who have to fend for themselves? Look, easy things and hard things simply do not exist. Life itself is what's hard. And you want to live, don't you? So you're wrong to call it your duty to take on what's hard. Their survival instinct pushes you to do that. So what is your duty? Your duty is to love what's hard. That you carry the weight doesn't say much. You have to rock it in its cradle and sing it to sleep and be there when it needs you. And it can need you at any moment. You have to be so ready to help, so gentle and kind, that you spoil it. Spoil your difficult thing like a child so that it can no longer exist without you, so that it depends on you. After you've brought it to such a state, you will no longer want anyone to come take it off your hands. And you get that far through love. To love is hard. When someone bids you to love, they are laying a great task upon you, but not an impossible one. For they are not calling you to love another person, which is not for beginners. They are not demanding from you that you love God, which only the most mature people can do. They are only calling your attention to what's hard for you, what is neediest in you and at the same time most fruitful. You see, what's easy wants nothing from you, but what's hard waits for you, and there is no strength in you that won't be needed there. And even if your life is very long, not a single day will be left over for what's easy, what scoffs at your strength. Go deep inside yourself and build what's hard. It should be like a house within you, if you yourself are like a land that changes with the tides. Remember, you are not a star. You have no course to follow. You must then be a world unto yourself and with your difficult thing in your center, drawing you to it. And one day, with its weight, its gravity, it will have its effects beyond you, on a destiny, on a person, on God. Then, when it's ready, God will enter into your difficult thing. And do you know anywhere else where you and he can meet so?
Did you say that you had found a piece in there where he talks about aliens?
Yeah.
I'm trying to remember if you actually said that to me or not, or if I imagined
it. Yeah, well, here's one thing. I found this piece to read a couple days ago. I was just looking through. I thought this might be nice to read.
Really? Yeah,
but the piece that is really wild is, you can see or get a flavor of his thought. You know, he's very subtle and spiritual and original and sort of ethical and so forth and so on. So very, that part of the brain is fully engaged, you know. But then I was reading this, and because he's always putting forth almost like being in the teacher role all the time.
Yeah.
So then I found this little thing. I'll just read you briefly where, I don't know if it's aliens, but he describes this as this is the weirdest thing. For somebody like, having read Rilke for years, and I see him as this, you know, sort of distinguished,
philosophical
you know, very formal.
Let's
see if I can find this. Oh, yeah. So this is like, so he has these notebooks, and some of these are just excerpts. So then there's this, I'll just read this little piece.
Yeah.
So it says, let nothing be preserved of that difficult, quote-unquote, alien disaster. So you don't know if he means what he means by that, but it's just so contrary to his way of being. Let nothing be preserved of that difficult, quote-unquote, alien disaster which descended upon me and drove me forth to G, who's a friend of his, one morning at 4. It was still night. A cold rain fell in the darkness when I had just begun the work of coming to my senses. No one will ever learn anything else from me except the silent account I entrust to these pages. But before I burn the small blue leather notebook, he's just so dramatic in this. I love this. Before I burn the small blue leather notebook that I took with me then on that journey, I want to set down this report of its condition. Barely 3 of its pages contain writing, but what thickly covers those pages, besides 2 addresses, make the many, many empty pages so disturbing to me, so uncanny, that I am throwing them all into the fire, too, as though infected and contaminated. I love his writing. It's like Poe here.
Jesus.
I transcribe here, without changing the least thing, one after the other, before I destroy them, the senseless words into which my once able spirit decomposed when an alien difficulty was suddenly poured over it like corrosive acid.
An alien difficulty?
Yeah.
Okay.
So then it says from the destroyed notebook, on the top edge, the word nightmare.
Well, yeah, that was the...
And then it says there were numbers at random, little meaningless sums. Mm-hmm. And then there's this listing of words, which I won't go on because it's just like something broke open in his head.
Yeah.
So here it is. Silver pleasure, roughness, rounded lot, lover, bruised sand, why never warning, lurking low, envy, glutton, blasting, longing, gnawer, path, branch, absorbed, fence, legend, innocence, hornet heart, film, morning dewfall, rumor ring, gentleness, evening cradle, living dish, bird constock, baptistry, troubles, dull, colorful applause. He just goes on in this completely.
List,
I mean, maybe I don't know how much this means to you, but knowing him, and he's just, for him to get into the surreal, you know.
He sounds panicked or something.
Yeah, yeah, it's just bizarre. It is kind of a panic.
Was he known to partake of the absinthe?
No, no. He drank a bit, but no. Just wine.
No. Okay.
He was obsessed with women and poetry.
I asked that question because I honestly don't know.
Yeah. But then it just goes on. The next page, return favorite diver birdhead. I love this line.
He's
fear, sweat, neckband, thorn-ripe vicuna.
The fuck is he talking about?
He's like a medium for some... That's what he means by an alien. Like he was
channeling
something.
Oh, maybe he just had a little break.
Yeah, a break of some... But I mean, it just for me, or you know, because I know him, and just for him to be saying that stuff, I thought, wow, that's pretty wild. All right, I'll read this one. Oh, and since it's appropriate, because it mentions bazooki. You know what a bazooki is?
Bazooka?
Yeah.
No, a bazooka.
Like an instrument?
Yeah, it's an instrument.
Oh, right.
It's like a lute. It's a lute that Greek culture.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that part of the world, I think. Not just necessarily Greece, but other areas around there. Mm-hmm. So, this figures in the poem.
Okay.
Called The Funeral Thief. They've erased my name from the dry board straddling the cracks in the sidewalk before Zeno's funeral parlor. My 3-day gig playing bazooki is up. Anyone who was going to drop by did. With tears and laughter, the hearts of the mourners were emptied, scoured, fortified. I sang to them of death as a large old constellation of which we know very little about. I sang to them of death as the dying into love and care of our aging bodies while we spin on the roof of this planet. I sang to them of death as my fingers cut grids of tenderness from gleaming metal strings. I reached out to the departed scout who was sharing the billing with me, dedicating the gift and light of music to the path he now travels upon. And I thanked my brothers and sisters again and again for the grace of our days, strength of our nights. I drank deep of their clear and haggard eyes, feeling the universe slowly widen.
Cool. I love that last line. That's a great last line.
Oh, thanks.
So there's this guy that comes to Rick and Melissa's open mic, whose name is Tom Sheehan. He's this older man who publishes a lot of work. And I'll read a couple poems of his. He's a Korea War veteran.
Mm-hmm.
And was up in Saugus.
Wow.
I think we talked about him last time, because you were talking about Saugus and your connection
there.
Yeah. So anyway, there's a couple of poems by him. He's amazingly good. Sign on a wall. The doughboard, oblique, worn to a frazzle, now hangs in the cellar way. Knuckles of love soft shoe across it. Like a fallow field it lies, 50 years since my mother powdered and rolled dough into its grain, beginning bread. Her hands, white-knuckled, went board to dough, to forehead, to the plain blue apron smelling of rolls, H-bones, sweat, and anxiety. She struggled great breads out of its surface, morning-fried dough sizzling in oil, a sure birthday cake 3 tiers tall on special days, and wrung from its granary pains and aches and tired bones, migraine, soft thunder, age, a shotted infirmity. That old board edges like fingers, hangs awry on a nail. My father drove to catch a jacket. If I bang it hard enough, fisted, belligerent about recall, a small cloud of powder floats her love.
Wow. That's beautiful.
Yeah. And this one's called A Voice Touching. A drunk startles me from a doorway. He cries against his mother's arms, into darkness and nothing of daylight, which has gone like a thief over the stone wall at street's end. His wail vibrates slowly off the curbstone, goes cold, curb gray, weak as a river, out of sight under thick alders. He is not alone despite all this loneliness, this cold street, September touching pavement, Saturday touching Sunday, acceptance, being what you are, and where you're supposed to be.
Spring on the line. Hello. Hello, is this Spring? Speaking. Where the hell you been? Where the hell you think? The Southern Hemisphere. Well, yeah, of course, but why do you abandon us every year and allow all this snow, cold, darkness, lethargy, depression, fatigue, weight gain? Shall I go on? Hey, relax, would you? You think I have any choice in the matter? No, I guess not. But still, I'm feeling you're kind of cavalier about the whole thing. What do you mean? I mean, couldn't you just hang out down there in Peru or Australia or wherever you're partying for just a month or so? Let us have the White Christmas, the Carrier Knives landscapes, a few snow days for the kids. Then come on back with the flowers and birds and sunny green stuff. Oh, sure. Stick it to the Peruvians and Australians and, quote-unquote, whoever I'm partying with. Let everyone and everything south of the equator get out of whack just so you mealy-mouthed northerners are more comfortable. Like I said, it's out of my control, and furthermore, you're being pretty damn self-centered, don't you think? Yeah, I guess you're right, and you're just working for the man too, I suppose. But couldn't you at least sit down and have a drink or two with Winter and tell him to knock off the snow come March? Listen, buddy, first of all, I don't drink. Don't need to when I've got all these colors and songs in my bag. And secondly, Winter and I haven't spoken in years, decades, eons. He's a terrible conversationalist, taciturn, icy, harsh. And when I do choose to socialize, it's usually with Summer at her place out on the island. So that's it then. Even though the sun has crossed the equator and it's officially spring, the days are still going to be frigid, the hats and gloves necessary, and more damn snow tonight. You got it, dude. But buck up, hang in there. You know I've always made good in my arrival. Meanwhile, be patient and grateful for the weather you have. Spring on Saturn? 200 degrees below zero with 500 mile per hour winds? I don't think so. Okay, I get your point. Thanks for your take on things and letting me vent for a while. No worries. And may I offer a suggestion that could make things easier for you? Sure, please do. Why not get out of your, quote-unquote, four seasons rut and insert a new one between winter and me? Some middle ground between darkness and light, cold and warmth, and the beginning. Seems like it would give you a boost psychologically and take the heat off me when I don't live up to your expectations. Huh, not a bad idea. I'll give it some thought. Anyway, I gotta move along now. I've got a lot of work to do and not much time to do it in. Yeah, I'll believe it when I see it. Oh, sorry. Schmuck, you'll be on your knees when I bring back the lilacs. Get back to me with that new season idea, okay? Okay, later. Later. That's it. A little...
I like that. That was pretty cool.
It's fun.
Nice.
It's fun.
It's called Promise, and it's a short poem. Promise. Soft sounds, not birds, but whispers. Teapot far away, not hissing, hushing. Ground like slippers, air like plump fruit. No leaves yet, but a promise rising. It's two tycoons. That one. I could read The Sly Universe and that kind of cover.
I don't like that one.
Okay, The Sly Universe. Be careful of the universe that plays tricks on you, that gives you a gift that stays too long and leaves too soon. A slack-jawed man in a cheap suit who becomes your lover because he likes the same brand of toothpaste you do. Be careful, be skeptical when it offers you a job that ends up paying you under the table. Be careful when it steals for you and you wind up with furniture that could have fallen off the back of a truck. Be wary when your friends show up for the party and it ends up awake. Beware the sly universe. It can snatch the cleats off your tap shoes in midair and the cushions off your old soft shoes when you land. Sure, be generous. Be wise, eat healthy, exercise, but count your fingers when it shakes your hand and check for fever when it blesses you for sneezing.
You wanna play the closing song?
Joe was a man,
and
thought he was a
woman.
And then he had Madonna.
But he knew
it
couldn't last.
I'm trying to be serious.
Joe was a man who thought he was a woman. And only knew that he knew last. Joe left his home in Tucson, Arizona. For some California grass. Get back to where you once belong. Get back to where you once belong. Took a bed of food and thought she was a woman, thought she was another man. All the girls around her said he got a problem, but she kissed while she can.
Version of that song I have.
That's a very nice version. Thank you. It met my requirement. Right, my criteria.